Good morning. It is an early start today. We have a ball game coming up. It'll be Minnesota versus North Dakota State at Venerable Williams Arena beginning at 12:30 today. So Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett starting a little bit early this week. And that will happen from time to time this winter during the basketball season. It's always my pleasure to introduce our host, Tom Schroer. Tom, how are you?
Doing great today. Thank you, Steve. It's been just a great holiday weekend here for us. Wonderful weather-wise, of course, for people who've had to travel and to get back home here to do their visiting. And so I hope you had a great holiday as well, Steve.
Oh, absolutely. My aunt always does a great job.
Very good.
Delicious.
We are excited again to be here, of course, as always, to share with our listeners another interesting topic. And this one of particular interest, I think, not only because of the time of year, but also because of the general economic circumstances that we're confronting these days, which have brought out, as it's tending to do always, more and more stories about people being victimized by fraud. And with us today is Kevin Bush. Kevin, welcome.
Morning, Tom.
Kevin is the chair of Moss and Barnett's Bank and Commercial Practice Group and our entire business department, as a matter of fact. Also, he's a director of our law firm. So, Kevin, thank you for joining us and bringing to bear your expertise with financial fraud.
We've picked probably the most unpleasant topic that we could for a holiday weekend. There really isn't anything nice that we can say about financial fraud. But it's an important topic because we're all vulnerable. It doesn't matter how old we are, how rich, how educated. We all are subject to being victimized by financial fraud, and we need to be alert to it.
We see more and more, too, of people getting ensnared in traps on the Internet, which are really quite beguiling and very, very difficult to decipher.
The Internet has many good qualities, but what it has done is expose more of us to more fraud more often.
Kevin, why is fraud so pervasive?
That sounds like a philosophical question.
Yes, without getting into the souls of human beings, but why does it seem to be coming out at this time?
One of the things that happens with fraud is when the economy sours, the aspects of a good economy that may have propped up the fraud starts to collapse, and the fraud then gets exposed because the money starts to run out.
And certainly we've seen that happening here at this time of year and in this point in our history.
We have.
We should be mindful, though, that it's not a new aspect of the human nature, and in fact one of our largest for many, many years towers here in the Twin Cities was a monument in a way to a fraud.
The Fauché Tower was built right before the Great Depression started, and Mr. Fauché lost everything in the stock market crash and eventually had to sell the building in bankruptcy.
But he was running as a way to gather the money to build the tower. He was running a pyramid scheme.
He was.
And now, Kevin, what is a pyramid scheme?
A pyramid scheme requires one to look at the shape of a pyramid. There's a person on the top, and the pyramid gets bigger and bigger as it goes down lower, and those people below are who are supporting the person at the top. And that person takes a lot of money, but the pyramid needs to keep getting bigger and bigger in order to keep supporting what's above it, and eventually the money runs out. And the pyramid will collapse.
Now, pyramid sales distribution arrangements are not illegal. They're not even fraudulent, though, are they?
They don't need to be.
But at some point when the business model fails, they can become a way to take money from those at the bottom of the pyramid and funnel it to the top.
Right. And the biggest problem in a illegitimate pyramid scheme is that the business model, the business plan, is either flawed or actually completely made up.
Now, one of the qualities of a fraudster, a fraud artist, are that they are so charming.
They always are. It's somewhat easy to romanticize the con artist. The person seems to have an appealing life, a nice house or two or three, very nice cars, takes exotic trips, often very active in social circles, political parties, sports events, arts.
Charities,
religious institutions. These are very charming people, and because of that are very successful in bringing new people in to provide more money to support this pyramid.
I have done a fair amount of work in the area of dealing with fraudsters myself, and one thing I've noticed, or two things I should say, are, first of all, they are the nicest people I have ever met in my life, and number two, they are the last people that you'd ever think of as having a dishonest bone in their body. They almost seem unfailingly honest, in fact.
Often we'll hear the stories from our clients who have been victimized who will say, and I think you'll agree, Tom, we hear this all the time, I can't believe I fell for that, or I can't believe I didn't see that coming. But the con artists play on that. They pretend to be very good people. They will often do little favors. They will often provide help. They are often very good listeners.
Now, we'll talk a little bit more about some specific kinds of fraud in a moment, but one thing that these schemes have in common, too, is that they're hard to detect.
They are hard to detect. Let me tell one story from a few years ago. A con artist locally targeted five or six different banks here for a con. One of the banks was very diligent and did a lot of what we call due diligence. That's inspection and detection of fraud, trying to make sure that the deal was very good. One of the other banks did almost none, really bumbled into the transaction. When the deal collapsed, it was the bank that had done all the due diligence who got hurt the worst. The bank that did no due diligence lost no money and, in fact, was the one that tipped over the fraud quite accidentally. And so it is very difficult even for trained professionals in the financial industry to see these coming and to deal with them properly.
And so there's an example of even large, sophisticated commercial organizations like banks, which are trained to look for these things, getting burned.
Yes.
Now, I know that another aspect of this is that they tend to always collapse under their own weight.
Eventually, the money runs out. At the end, there will be a scramble, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And at some point, the scramble becomes so desperate that there'll be a mistake, and the deal will typically collapse at that point.
Well, a great example would be the pyramid scheme, that they're just eventually you run out of people that are willing to come into the scheme to fund the people at the top, that there aren't any more gullible participants.
I'm not sure I'll say there are no more gullible participants, but the math becomes daunting very quickly.
Sure.
The size of at the base of the pyramid has to grow so fast in order to support it that we do run out of people.
And now, Kevin, in that regard, though, once a scheme collapses, we'll be wanting to talk a little bit later about some of the tools that are available for victims and law enforcement officials to clean up the mess.
The con artists almost always leave a very good trail to permit a conviction by law enforcement. Their computer records and paper records are extensive. Very often we'll see guilty pleas. We do a much poorer job of taking care of the victims because there often is very little money left. Even if millions have been stolen, there may be only pennies or hundreds left.
Well, there is irony there that maybe the Internet makes it, in this computer age, makes it easier for some people to commit fraud, but on the backside, the computer and the Internet paper trail may eventually allow convictions or make it easier to convict the fraud at some point.
I think the prosecutors like white-collar crime, financial crime cases, because they really do result in convictions very easily.
But don't expect to get your money back.
It's very tough. We often find that we're spending a lot of money trying to allocate losses among innocent victims, and the allocation process, while important, takes a lot of money itself.
Mm. So even, Kevin, when a party's been convicted of criminal fraud and they've been ordered to pay restitution, that doesn't ensure that they'll have the resources ever with which to make restitution.
A very large fraud recently was committed by a man by the name of Lou Pearlman. This was mostly down in Florida, although he had some activity here as well. He was recently convicted on a plea bargain and was sentenced to 300 months in jail. The judge offered him a deal to reduce his sentence by 1 month for every $1 million that he recovered, because he was accused of stealing $300 million. So far, there has not been any reduction to his sentence.
Wow. Scary stuff. Joining us in studio, Kevin Bush of Moss & Barnett's Banking and Commercial Transactions Practice Group. We're talking about financial fraud, avoidance, detection, and recovery. Our phone number on the program, as always, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Your calls welcome, as always. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett. This is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. Our phone lines are open, as always, on the program. The number is 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Our program started 30 minutes early today. We have a ball game coming up from Williams Arena, Minnesota, against North Dakota State, beginning at 12:30 today. Typically, Minnesota Law comes your way at noon each and every Saturday.
Steve, we're going to title the next segment here of our program, If It's Too Good to Be True, It Probably Is.
Great advice.
and so, Kevin Bush, one of the things that we've read about lately in the news quite a bit is something called a Ponzi scheme. What is a Ponzi scheme?
To understand Ponzi schemes, we have to go back to Charles Ponzi. He was a real person back in the early 1900s out on the East Coast. He wasn't actually the inventor of the Ponzi scheme. It's probably been around for hundreds or thousands of years. But he popularized it, if we can use that term, by doing it at a very high level with a media component that made it very notorious very quickly.
So you say he wasn't the inventor of this? He couldn't have patented this business method?
I have to talk to David Beek about that.
All right.
So what last week's program.
Exactly. So what did he do then, Kevin?
He came up with a get-rich-quick scheme that involved, of all things, international postage charges. And it sounds ludicrous to even say it now, but he convinced thousands of people to invest millions of dollars with him based on a premise that he could buy postage stamps here quickly and or cheaply and sell them abroad at a higher price, essentially. He at one point was taking in $250,000 a day, and this is back in the early 1900s, so it's a lot of money. It collapsed after a very short time because the business model was so flawed that it really had no strength behind it. He went to jail. He died penniless. But his name lives on in Ponzi schemes.
And so part of his appeal was that he had a pretext for being able to generate these fantastic returns on the investment that his victims were putting into it. Namely, he was supposedly trading postage stamps, of all things, internationally. I mean, go figure. Postage stamps are only good in the country that issues them, right?
But I'm starting to sound like I'm going to promote Ponzi's scheme here, but remember that when postage is put on a stamp, put on an envelope and mailed internationally, the second half of that delivery is handled in the foreign country, and there's a sharing arrangement between the different countries to settle up on the cost of handling postage.
So there is a liquidity event at least.
Right.
All right. So what was it that caused him to get caught?
Eventually, it just collapsed. He had all his friends and relatives invested, and they told all of their friends and relatives, and eventually sort of everybody in town knew about it, but people started to ask questions, and eventually the money stopped flowing in, and once it stopped flowing in, the whole thing had to collapse.
So was the nature of the crime rendered even more outrageous because of the nature of the victims?
Yes, they were, by and large, individuals, relatively low income, all of whom were impressed with his ability to generate seemingly huge amounts of money, and they wanted to be part of that.
And so back to our theme or title for this segment, which is, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. How can somebody know what's too good to be true? I mean, we do hear about hedge funds in the big money centers earning upwards of 25-30% returns for their investors. We hear about people doubling their money in investments. How is a person to know, looking at the outside in, what is too good to be true?
It's very difficult. One of the questions that I would like people to ask themselves is, why me? Why am I being offered this opportunity when there are financial institutions out there who are struggling hard to earn 6%, 8% on their money, and I'm being offered 15 or 20? Why am I so smart?
All right, so it comes down to a question of how much the interest rate is or the rate of return?
Certainly, an interest rate that is higher than the market is a strong signal that there's a problem.
And that makes sense because, after all, if a party's out raising money, why would they promise to pay 20, 25, 30%? I mean, we've been hearing in recent times of a Ponzi scheme where the offer was 70% interest. Why would anybody with a good business model need to borrow at that interest rate when they can go down to a commercial bank or perhaps even the stock market and raise capital to work with for quite a bit less?
Right. Another sign of concern is the urgency request. You need to invest now. If you don't invest today, it won't be available tomorrow. A deal this good ought to be available for more than a day or two.
And what about details available? I would assume the urgency is one, but about details, a prospectus, if you will, because a lot of investments, you get detailed, even if you have a 401k, you get these detailed things in the mail explaining all the ins and outs of a particular investment.
Most of the time, these Ponzi schemes are not securities, or at least they purport not to be securities, so they're not supported by any substantial documentation. They don't require any public filings. So the information that you get is not very significant.
One thing I've noticed about these as well is it's common in the Ponzi scheme dealing with the unsophisticated people to have them at a group meeting for a presentation, and almost invariably the group meeting is attended as well by a certified professional like an accountant or a lawyer, somebody who's licensed, who doesn't really know what's going on but is there to add credibility to the operation.
Right.
We've got much more coming up on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Our guest attorney today, Kevin Bush of Moss & Barnett's Banking and Commercial Transactions Practice Group, on the topic of financial fraud, avoidance, detection, and recovery. We have much more coming up. Tom Schroyer, our host in studio. It's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett. Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss & Barnett. An early start today at 11:30. We have a ball game coming up at 12:30. Minnesota takes on North Dakota State at Williams Arena. So we moved up 30 minutes. Typically, we come your way each and every Saturday at noon here on News Radio 830 WCCR. Host Tom Schroyer from Moss & Barnett. Our special guest today, Kevin Bush, from Moss & Barnett's Banking and Commercial Transactions Practice Group, on the topic of financial fraud, avoidance, detection, and recovery. Tom?
Thanks, Steve. We're going to switch gears a little bit here now and move on to talking about a different kind of fraud, and that is fraud on a business by an employee. Kevin, these can be some of the most vicious and, at the same time, heartbreaking kinds of episodes because oftentimes they bring a business to its knees or even into failure, wrecking the jobs of innocent co-workers.
Often the perpetrator is a longtime employee, very trusted employee, maybe even considered a member of the family. And the problem may continue for years and years without detection, to some extent because of denial by the employer.
There seems to be some commonality between these kinds of episodes as well, wouldn't you say? Is what that's true?
Yes. We see a pattern. Obviously, the most simple type is simple cash pilferage, the employee taking money out of the till. That tends not to go on for very long and can't be very much money. more difficult are the case of the fictitious payee, as we call it, where an employee creates a vendor or another employee number to which checks are issued, and that can go on for a long time.
Sometimes a bookkeeper will change the name of the payee on a check, or will simply intercept a check and endorse it over to himself or herself and run it through the bank.
Right. Sometimes the employee will create a name that is similar to the employer's name, create a business and a fake business, open a bank account, and simply deposit the checks from the employer into a separate bank account.
We've seen many, many different kinds of motives for these kinds of activities as well, everything ranging from needing to pay gambling debts to, I had a case once I worked on, Kevin, where the thief built a huge church in the hometown area. It was unbelievable.
The motives are sometimes hard to figure out. Sometimes the money is used for what appear to be good purposes. Most often, we do see a gambling problem or a drug problem.
And sometimes a lifestyle problem as well. People get addicted to, you know, shopping the credit card for a new wardrobe or other kind of personal luxuries on a recurring basis. But those kinds of activities can add up very quickly, notwithstanding that they might be in low dollar amounts at any given time.
And the employee can often justify this for himself or herself by saying, I've never been paid enough anyway. I'm more valuable to this business than they give me credit for.
Right, and I've seen bookkeepers who've said that they thought it was okay for them to do it because the boss or upper management got to take off and go golfing once in a while or take longer lunch breaks. So there are lots of different kinds of motivations that can be involved here.
Yes.
The situation, though, is that it's really everyone's job in a business to keep an eye out for this sort of thing.
It is, starting with the senior management or the owner of the business in a small business. The most important rule or prevention technique is what we call dual control, or the flip side of that is separation of duties. No employee should be able to handle cash or checks all by himself or herself.
And so that you'd have to have somebody signing checks different from the person who actually cuts or prepares them.
Preparation and signing should be different. When the bank statement comes, a different person should reconcile the bank statement from the person who prepared the checks.
And so a business owner who delegates all of that to just one person is really almost begging for trouble.
Those are the hardest cases.
Is there a situation, too, where it might be good to have maybe outside accounting come in and look at the books? Would that be something that a business owner could do or should do to have an outside check on what's going on there?
I would say, Steve, based on our experience, that certainly accountants coming in from the outside can provide some detection, but they're just not there often enough. And the kinds of reviews or audit procedures that they employ are just not in-depth enough in order to uncover these kinds of things, so that even the best audit or the best review by an outside accountant can allow these things to fester and go undetected for many, many years until really it becomes so large as, again, to cause a problem. So it's really not, it seems to us, a good idea for a business owner to count on one of these outsiders coming in on a very limited basis once
sure.
a year and detecting it, because, among other things, between the year cycles when the outside accountant is there, the bookkeeper or whomever could take a phenomenal amount of money and avoid detection.
So the internal checks and balances are crucial in this case.
It's not only, it seems to me, a question of having those in place to provide detection, but also they serve a watchdog kind of a function. Just the barking dog keeps the burglar away at night, even if they are really not very effective
sure.
as watchdogs.
One of the things we need to be very careful of in a small business particularly is the employee who volunteers to take care of everything, and the job continues to expand And the employee says, I'll take care of the mail. Don't worry about it. I can take care of reconciling the checkbook. Don't worry about it. At some point, the owner simply has to say, no, you've done enough for me. We need to separate these duties out.
How about vacations and this particular kind of a person, Kevin?
The employee who is engaged in fraud will not take a vacation, will never have a sick day because the employee is going to be worried that the fraud will be detected while he or she is not there to watch the mail, to intercept the bank statements. So in accounting departments of businesses, there often is a rule that an employee must take a vacation. It must be of a sufficient length to expose any problems that are developing underneath, often 2 weeks.
So in addition to paying attention to the employee's lifestyle, to have some sense as to whether or not they're in over their head either with consumer debt or gambling, but also to separate duties and have these sorts of controls in place. But wouldn't it also be important for the owner of a business to maintain a very strong ethical tone at the top?
Certainly that. It sets the tone for the employees and avoids the creating a culture of fraud.
And so it really is a situation where a pound of, or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Background checks are important in this area. There are many employee frauds that have moved from employer to employer.
I know that our firm is being called upon more and more by clients of all kinds of sizes to run just a simple name search through our sophisticated internet databases that we have access to, because you know, these are not available to everyone. They're something that people have to purchase. I know a number of accounting firms offer that too, and it's amazing what kind of information will show up through even actually just a Google search of a name.
You can get good information. You can't rely on it completely because the information may not show up on all the databases. It is very common, in my experience, to see an employee who has committed the same fraud at another place, and there will be a record of the conviction or the plea bargain in the public records in the same county, and no one ever looked.
Amazing.
We have more coming up. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Our guest attorney today, Kevin Bush from Moss and Barnett's Banking and Commercial Transactions Practice Group. The topic, financial fraud avoidance, detection, and recovery. Our show ends at 12:30 today. We've got a ball game from Williams Arena, Minnesota, and North Dakota State. Generally, we come your way each and every Saturday between noon and 1 o'clock here on News Radio, 830 WCCO. Welcome back one more time. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. We come your way each and every Saturday at noon. We got started a little earlier today. Tom Schroyer, the host of our program, and Kevin Bush is our guest attorney.
Thanks, Steve. We're going to talk now about the many types of fraud that have been propagated by the Internet or facilitated by the Internet. Kevin, we are seeing more and more of these kinds of creatively planned and executed types of fraud, and really they're particularly insidious because most of it doesn't even necessarily come from the U.S.
Many of these do come from foreign countries, and they're hard to track. The Minnesota just announced an initiative about a week ago, a cooperative effort among a number of state agencies and a number of local businesses and trade association under the name of minscams.org, minscams.org. It's a nice website, an effort by the state to try to address some of these Internet fraud problems.
Kevin, what are some of the more prominent of the Internet types of fraud that you've been seeing?
One goes under the general heading of phishing, spelled an odd way, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, sort of phishing by using phony information. And a typical version of it is an email that you get at the office or at home that will appear to be from a bank or appear to be from the IRS or some other governmental agency saying that there's been an urgent problem with your account, and please respond to this particular link. Answer this email. These are always a fraud. No bank will ever send an email to you asking you to provide any private information over the internet, and neither will a government entity.
And I've seen these guys. I've received these, and they will steal the logo of a particular bank. But I get emails from banks that I've never done business before, which I find curious. I've never banked with that particular bank, but they're able to use the logos. It's really amazing what they're able to accomplish.
I too, Steve, have received these on numerous occasions, and I must say, Kevin, it's easier said than done to say no to them because they look very, very real, authentic, and they have the urgency, the imperative need for action now that is very, very imposing.
It is, and the logo may be an exact duplicate. The website address may be an exact duplicate, but behind it is the fraudulent connection. Sometimes, as Steve says, it's coming from a bank that you've never dealt with before. That's a tip-off. Your account there is in jeopardy, and you don't have an account. Other times, the language choice or the production quality isn't quite there. Appears to have been translated from some foreign language. But sometimes they are absolutely excellent, and there is a temptation to respond, and you simply have to say to yourself, I will not respond to something like this on the internet because they will not be legitimate.
So the operative word there is never on an email.
Never on an email.
All right. And what should a person do when they see one of these things aside from not engage?
Deleting it is a good choice. There are a number of places one can report it to the entity itself so that they know that the fraudsters are out using the logo. And some of the governmental agencies will take these reports as well.
Another one of these scams that we've been seeing involves the use of bad checks that really are quite authentic appearing as well.
Yes. Any number of circumstances can result in this problem. An example is somebody who has listed a product for sale on one of the internet auction sites and will get a nice notice from a buyer that says, yes, I'm happy to buy that, and I'll send the check for the $400 to you. A couple of days later, a check arrives. It's a cashier's check. It looks good. And it's actually for $500, or maybe it's for $4,000. And the person who sent it will call and say, I made a mistake. I sent you too much money. Will you send me a check in refund? And, of course, the person who sold the product is very happy about this and sends the check back. And what happens is even weeks later, it turns out that that check is counterfeit.
So the first check turns out to have been a counterfeit, and the person who has refunded the overpayment has paid good money and received what in return?
Nothing.
Unbelievable. Now, and do those checks that come in payment, do they look real?
They will be absolute identical to the real check. One of the services I subscribe to provides a listing of banks around the country that have had bad checks in circulation, and it's updated every week with new names.
And now, most people, I would assume, wait until the check clears and they have cash in their account before they'd refund that alleged overpayment. Why wouldn't that be sufficient?
Because the check will clear in the sense that money will be made available very quickly, several days. But it may take a much longer time to prove that the check itself was counterfeit, and then it'll come back up through the banking channels.
How long does a person have to wait, quickly stated, before they can be sure that they have the real deal?
There isn't a sharp number on that. It can be a long time.
Thanks, guys. Tom Schroyer, host on our program today. Once again, a big thanks. Kevin Bush from Moss & Barnett's Banking and Commercial Transactions Practice Group. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss & Barnett. Available online at moss-barnett.com. Our program comes your way each and every Saturday at noon.